I miss a green, for example, I'm already upset. When I find my ball in the bunker, I'm really upset. And when I find my ball in a
fried egg.
The dreaded fried egg.
Fried egg lie, I'm about ready to run off the golf course.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to another edition of the Fried Egg Podcast. I'm your host, Andy Johnson, and today I'm joined by the illustrious golf writer, part-time golf course architect, Jeff Shackelford. Jeff, thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me, Andy. Good to be here.
Yeah. I mean, how are you recovering from such a entertaining, packed weekend of golf? You know, all these events played at the same time on different networks. What were you watching?
I was going back and forth and bemoaning the fact that they were all ending at the same time and muttering things about how we need more West Coast venues and tournament golf because I do that in general. Mm-hmm. But also because it helps spread out finishes. So I they weren't the greatest golf tournaments in the history of the world, but when you see a Danielle Kang and that kind of a great story and emotional story, you kind of would like to be sitting there just savoring that one and enjoying it. And then, the Senior Open, you never know what's going to happen in a USGA event like that. I'd kind of like to have savored the finish there. And then, anything at TPC, whatever it's called, Avenel Potomac, something or other. They've changed it there. Is it Potomac at Avenel Farms, I think, is the full name. But anyway, yeah. It's weird things happen there, and it was kind of a wacky finish down the stretch with some oddball characters, which I like. And so, yeah, one of them should have been finished today, and this is just a problem golf has with scheduling. There's a lot of stuff out there, and the groups don't always see eye to eye on when to finish these things, and then we end up with something like that.
Yeah, I mean, it would have been nice if they had tournament action over Saturday, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, essentially gotten 4 days of weekend action, but, it is what it is. So, a question I've always wondered is how did you kind of get into golf course architecture? Obviously, it's something you wrote a ton about early in your career, and just was curious about that.
Well, from a pretty young age, I was interested in drawing golf holes for some unknown reason, like a lot of people. And then I was very lucky in that my dad took me on a lot of trips when he was announcing college basketball. And even back when he was with the Lakers, I even went on a couple trips then. But when he went to work for American Golf Corporation and acquisitions, we traveled to a lot of places and saw a lot of rundown munis that they were looking to try and acquire. And then we also played some good golf courses in those areas. So that got my interest going. And then obviously he joined Riviera when I was 16 and then had George Thomas's book. So that combination of getting to see that and study George Thomas's writings was really important as well. And then things kind of went to another level when they did the restoration project. And I was kind of near the end of my time in college and losing interest in playing and fascinated by what that course had been. And I started kind of doing research on my own and started showing some of that to Ben and Bill and to Jim McPhillamy, the superintendent at the time there, who was running the job. And unfortunately, I was finding things that they didn't know about or they had suspected existed but had no documentation of. And so their project in 1993 was more of a restoration of the Evolved course, if that makes sense. And so that was kind of that was fun, and then I got to know them and learn from them and Dave Axelin and Dan Proctor, the Shapers, and So it was just a combination of things that happened, and but it's always been something I've been just naturally drawn to.
It's interesting. I wanted to talk a little bit about Riviera later. Curious, since you've done a lot of research on it, and I know, you know, everybody that watches Golf Channel knows you love the way the water moves off the golf course. But if you were going to do one kind of thing, like if say they hired you to do a restoration tomorrow and a kind of long range plan, what would be the first thing that you do to that golf course?
Probably reclaim the look of the Barranca and try and get that what you see in the old photos of a sandy wash through the course, and then up the 13th hole on the left side and down the middle of the 8th and down the right of the 7th. I mean, that was the thing at LA Country Club that I bent Gil's ear about over and over again, and he was in agreement, and we had to get the Barranca back because there's just nothing like that element of a golf course. You can do great bunkers, you can have great strategy and beautiful green complexes and this and that and restore hole locations, but if you don't have that kind of the color, the texture, the all the elements, the coolness that a sandy Barranca brings, because there's really nothing quite like them in terms of hazards and in golf, and it's kind of a something that's unique to Southern California to have these sandy washes that you can go and hit a recovery shot from, and they function, they're part of the way the golf course plays in the wintertime, et cetera, et cetera, and mostly just the look. And so that's where Riviera has just become kind of it's a two color golf course. It's green and it's got white bunker sand and trees, and it's lost a certain visual,
identity,
intrigue.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's interesting. I, you know, you think about Riviera and it, you know, being there, you know, it's definitely a site that wasn't blessed with a lot. I mean, it's a canyon.
No,
this a small,
no, it was awful, really.
Yeah, like, you know, when you talk about the great golf course in the world, it's got to be one of the best with one of the worst sites. You know, in your opinion, is it one of the three or four most architecturally sound golf courses?
Not as much now. It still is, but they've just taken so many great subtleties and cool elements of it out, either just through ignorance or just not really understanding it. And so I just feel like when you see where so many other golf courses have gone in the restoration movement we've seen, and Riviera's gone backwards, that it's really fallen far behind. And I never would have said that. I mean, growing up there, if I match played it, I think you and I may have discussed this, but if I match played it against LA North, it always won 2-1, 3-2 handily. And that was me being charitable, thinking I had a home course, homerism thing going. And now it's the other way around. LA breezes to an easy 2-1, 3-2 victory, depending on my mood. And it's just, there's just too many weak elements. I think the thing that stands out for me there is when the University of Texas guys were going there for the NCAAs, their coaches asked my dad and I about local knowledge and things they should be on the lookout for. And it was sad. I went through it and there was really only one great sucker pin left. They had kind of taken some of the angles out with the green enlargements, where the course used to have several great hole locations that you would just think, oh, I can go at that, and the way the bunkers were angled, it was idiotic, and they've eliminated those. And it's little stuff like that, when you take that out of a strategic course and a course that had evolved in a certain way, that I think is unfortunate.
Yeah, I mean, it is interesting how, you know, everybody's doing this restoration thing, and, you know, it's seemingly everybody's coming out winners from it, but, you know, they have, you know, more money and, you know, ability to do, you know, restoration more so than almost any club in the country. And yet they haven't really done a true restoration.
No, it's unfortunate, and they had every opportunity to, and many people tried to guide them there, but they don't want to do that. And I've heard they're now again looking at trying to put water in the Branca again. So you're kind of the polar opposite of what I would do there. So it's a helpless cause, sadly.
So, you know, maybe we'll go to a little bit, you know, brighter subject. We'll stay in the LA area. And, you and Gil completed your work at LACC South Course earlier this year. And, you know, I'm just kind of curious about, you know, the project, you know, what the goal was. And, you know, now that you've had a few months, how's the member feedback been?
Well, it was the second course there. In architecturally, as long as I've been alive and for a long, long time. And but the course that got more play, and it was probably 60% there and 40% on the north. Well, after the north was redone, the combination of the better grass and conditioning for most people, and then obviously the better architecture for certain players there, made the north just much more popular. And it shifted the other way to 60%. Of the play there, and maybe even 70%. And so the goal was to get the South back to where people wanted to play it. And then there were some issues with a neighboring building that has yet to be built, but will be built eventually, between the Beverly Hilton and the South Course, that was going to, in our insane world, put the club in a bad spot where even though it's been there 120 years, that tee shots that would go into that new building would be the problem of the club. So they needed us to reroute some holes on that end of the course, and it turned into an open canvas, really, once we showed them that rerouting. And the decision was made, well, if we're going to do this, let's do it right. That's kind of how they are there, and it's just a great club that way. And so I got to spend a lot of time trying to come up with different routing scenarios, and Gil would chime in, and we and Russ Myers, the superintendent, would. And it was the most difficult thing I've ever worked on, because we had to keep the holes basically on the perimeter playing the same way in terms of tee shots, so that if we started sending balls onto streets or into houses that had not gotten those before, we would have been in trouble, and nobody wanted that. So it was great fun, but it was incredible how many phone calls there'd be. Either Gil would have an idea, and I'd have to go check it out, or Russ would have an idea, and we'd start talking it through, and then we'd realize we had back-to-back par threes, or we had par 69, or we had 19 holes, or we had 17 holes. It was insane. It was fun. And then one day it finally kind of clicked. In one respect, I found a hole that I was excited about. But we still had one little problem, and I remember the day very vividly. And Gil, I think on a Friday night, was looking at something and figured something out, and said, would you go check this out? And so I went out and on a Saturday, and it was kind of fun. I had just, well, it was weird. I did a morning drive that morning and was defending Ted Bishop, who had been in a little scandal. And I went over there, and I took pictures of where, and called Gil and said, I think it works. It's a little uphill par three. And we finally had our 18 holes kind of pieced together. And so that hole, I really like. That's the one hole that in the member feedback they're still on the fence about. It's a little short uphill par three with a pretty severe green. But the feedback's been very positive. A couple of the par threes are tough for them because the greens are new and firm. Mm-hmm. And but other than that, the feedback's been sensational. It's done what we'd hoped. It's gotten the play back over there, and good players love it. And it's really a beautiful property, and it's a very different property than the north. You're right. It's like golf in Central Park. And so the contrast between the two is just incredible.
Yeah, I always like when clubs, you know, like as opposed to like Baltusrol, where you have like just two, you know, courses that are going to beat you up day in, day out, where you have a little bit of a contrast, where you have, you know, your U.S. Open Walker Cup course on the north course, and then you've got something that's a little bit, you know, more playable and you know, member friendly on the south course. So you know, you you see, you know, the ability to, you know, really have two different golf experiences in one.
Yeah, and that was something that, you know, so when I hear some of the feedback that this hole's too hard or that's too hard, you know, that we cringe at, because we did want this to remain fun and a totally different vibe that a good player could go out with not as good players, and they could still have a fun game. And for the most part, I think that's been the case. And when you have a new course and new greens, that's just one of the things that you have to ask for patience on. But it was really, really a fun project to be a part of, and to work in the middle of the city like that, and to try to do something that was different than the North, but also didn't, you know, that was the other thing we had to deal with, was do we want to just create a smaller version of the North? Because, you know, Captain Thomas had started developing plans for the South and redid the first green, and it was a pretty zany green with a bunker cut into it, and you're thinking, well, he was going to go pretty nuts with this golf course with short holes, and then he passed away. So we tried to do some things on the course that were in the vein of what would George Thomas do on a shorter version of a course like this, and what would Billy Bell, how would he construct it? But we also did some things that went against that. We toned down the bunkers a little bit, and things like that to make it different, but not make it, I mean, we even toyed with, like, do we do a Rainer style look? And so they're totally different looking. And we just felt like that was never going to look quite right. So I feel like we found the right blend.
Yeah. So something I think is interesting about kind of your career. So you start, you know, you're a golf writer, and, you know, you write a lot about architecture, and now you've, you know, kind of, you know, morphed into a architect, you know, yourself, you know, and I think a lot of people that are into architecture always think, hey, you know, it'd be so cool to get to design your own course. What have you seen that is the toughest aspect of architecture that you didn't expect it, now that you've been out in the field, you know, building golf courses?
Probably the politics of it, the convincing whoever is in charge of the money and of what you want to do and what they need to have done, and what they have is in terms of a site or an existing course. It's fairly relentless, and it's in terms of the campaigning and the effort you have to make to convince people that something would be good. And I mean, that was the fun part at LA. It was not initially, it was a tough sell, and we had a lot of opposition. And then it was the opposite on the South. We had very little opposition, and it was almost you know, Gil and I would look at each other, I guess nobody really is too worried about what we're going to do, so let's do it. And that was fun as well. But it's that's a tough part of the job. I think that part of the job's gotten slightly easier with the change in the last probably 5 to 7 years of people going into projects, just being more aware of what's good design and what's sensible design, what's sustainable. And I think the biggest shift is the finally, we seem to be over, for the most part, not always, but for the most part, the obsession with difficulty, and people are asking architects more and more. They want fun, and that's, to me, really, really encouraging for the game. It may be too late, but you never know. But I think it's been a great shift that you see that now with you hear that with so many projects.
Yeah, you know, curious. You know, when you got your start and started writing, and you know, you're kind of in the dark ages of architecture, you know, did you just feel like a black sheep at all times?
No, because there were other people with the same mindset. Yeah, I mean, I got the black sheep treatment when I started venturing into writing about distance. Mm-hmm. And I mean, literally to the point where there were certain companies that were encouraging people not to use me for writing work. And there were, you know, essentially they were threatened by that discussion. And, And I understood that. It's a sensitive subject. But even that subject's starting to change now. Finally, it took a while, but in terms of architecture, no, I think it was, there were enough quality people who were like-minded that made me think, okay, yeah, this is worth looking into and pursuing. And the people that I think are smart and really like and who love the game are into this too. And so that part of it never felt that odd. It was more of trying to convince people, okay, look at these photos we found. Wouldn't this be better? And I think that was the hard part. And I think the part that's changed now with Photoshop, with Google Earth, and all these different visual tricks, it is a lot easier to convince people of what something used to look like and how it would look, how that would be the better look now for a course.
Yeah, I think that's, I mean, the biggest thing I see, you know, the place I play golf here in Chicago is just like is so overgrown. And then you look at the old photos and there's no trees anywhere, you know, and they've planted thousands of trees. And, you know, I talk to members and they're like, you know, hey, those trees have been here forever. I point to a picture in the clubhouse and there's none there. And it limits the amount of strategy when you don't have any width. Obviously, you know, you see it even on tour. You know, I'd be interested to hear what your thoughts were on Erin Hills and, you know, kind of the course and, you know, how it played out. You know, I think it's a very polarizing topic in golf.
Polarizing in this, you mean the post Erin Hills reaction is polarizing?
Yeah, I think, you know, obviously people just get so hung up on par, but, you know, in my eyes, I looked at that course and I thought it delivered a really good championship, and we saw a variety that on the leaderboard that we'd never seen before with different styles of play in a U.S. Open. And I look at it and I attribute it to the width.
Yeah, I am with you on that. You know, I didn't have, I wouldn't say high hopes for that one, for Erin Hills. And in part, you know, I look at not just the design, but also just the, how's it going to function as a venue? Is it going to have energy? And is it going to be somewhat reasonable to get to? And so getting there actually worked really well. The energy on site was great because the fans there are so passionate. And it was a beautiful, it was very much like an Open championship, especially Sunday when it cooled off a little and the wind was blowing. It was eerie how much it felt like an Open in the UK. But on television, it was interesting that the reaction was, well, where were the people? Where was the energy? And it really, I think, was a learning experience for a lot of people to then go to Connecticut the next week where you had people right on top of the action and how that totally changed the energy for the person watching at home. But then, of course, as you know, so many people seized on that winning score, and it was par 72. The greens were absolutely immaculate. The width was sensational, and I think necessary based on what everybody tells me there on what happened on Saturday before the Open with the wind, that they have days there where if you don't have that width, they're just going to have a freak show out there. So it was unfortunate it rained. And that made the width play even more substantial than some people would like. But, you know, other than them not spotting the overspray and the high rough right off the edges and dealing with that sooner, the place was immaculately presented. The architecture was way better than when I first went there and way more interesting And so I view it as a positive Open, and then we'll remember it as one. And I think history will be kind to it as well. I don't think anybody's going to sit there and go, well, that was a disaster. And you know, the other thing, Andy, is, you know, from a plane, people just forget how awful the feeling is when a U.S. Open or any major or any golf tournament is tainted by course setup, where you feel like it went too far and it cost somebody the championship for reasons that can't really be explained other than it went too far. So if you err a little bit on the other side, I'm sorry, but that's just infinitely better.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think it allowed everybody to play their style of game. I mean, like,
I think,
you know, like the short grass around the greens, even to extent, allowed people that are great at short, you know, at chipping and pitching the ball, a place to showcase their skills. Because, you know, in a traditional U.S. Open, you know, you get in 7-inch rough around the greens, and no matter how great you are, you're probably not going to get up and down. But you saw Patrick Reed on Saturday put on a clinic, and the whole day he was short-sided.
Yeah, absolutely. And they manage those areas very carefully, and I don't know how much that came through to people watching from afar, but they had different mowing heights for some. They were nervous about a lot of things going into this Open, and rightfully so. They did not want to have a bad week. They didn't want to have a week with balls rolling up and down greens. And so I think they did the right thing airing the way they did and got a very deserving champion.
So do you think Aaron Hills, you voting yes for another Open?
I think it will probably get one, but I think it'll be a long time, partially because they're so already locked into so many venues. But I think it will get another one. I don't know if it would be my top choice, to be honest. There's just so many places that, I mean, when you look at where they're going the next 8 venues, and likely actually the next 10 if they go to some of the places we suspect, there's just something about the places with history and architecture and stories that you kind of love to hear, and great ways to remind people of the past and other tournaments, that's just different than going to the new venues. And I think that's my only issue with going to Chambers and Erin Hills the way they did, that they only had one amateur, and in Erin Hills' case of public links and amateur public links. And I think you just have to go places where you have to have more events on them before you go there. In fact, LA Country Club, well, somebody will say, well, wait a second, they're going to get the U.S. Open, and all they're going to have is a Walker Cup. And I think it's after seeing what I saw at Erin Hills, I would like to see LA Country Club host one or two things like a U.S. Open sectional qualifying. Just get a few more things in there to just see how good players play on a course, because it's very difficult, as you know, to envision what a course is going to play like with really good players on it until you get it kind of ramped up and in tournament condition and get those players out there. And I think that was something that hurt both Chambers and Erin Hills, especially because they're more complicated golf courses and scale and turf and location and all that than
people,
say an inland course like LA, and people.
You know, like, yeah, getting people around the course. You know, the LACC had the Pac-12s a couple of years ago, right? And I did. As I remember, the feedback was really positive for that also.
No, oh, it was amazing. It was so fun. You know, the first day, scoring was incredible, and because they had it set up a little easier, and then it just got tougher and tougher in a good way, and it was so much fun to watch, and it was so fascinating. I mean, my favorite memory of that was on the in the final round, Casey Martin was going out on the 15th green when his player would get up on the tee and directing them where to hit their shot to land it so that it would then spin down properly to the hole, because the hole was playing 95 yards. It's a short par 3. The pin was up. They were playing the red tee box, and although the reds are now gone, but it's another color now. I think it's green. But it was just fun to watch that the golf course get firm to the point where a coach was watching what other guys were doing, was able to tell the players that, and it was intense. I mean, it was really, by the last round, it was an intense test of golf, and just great fun to watch.
Yeah, it's interesting with college golf how involved the coaches are with, like, you know, like that. I went to the NCAAs this year, and you know, it was kind of my first in person exposure. But I mean, like, they are like almost more involved than a caddy would be, and you know, instructing these kids where to hit their shots, reading putts. I mean, it's interesting how, like, they're able to, you know, they're almost better than a caddy because they could go watch, you know, another team play a hole, five holes before you get there.
Yeah, and that was the interesting thing for me at the Pac-12s, because there are coaches who don't do that. They have a very simple style, and they sit back. And then I noticed it, though, on the NCAAs, on the telecast more than ever, how many more coaches are getting out there and essentially caddying. And I think for the most part that's a good thing for a player, but there were a few times where you were like, coach, get off the green, okay? You don't need to tend the flag, and you don't need to shake your guy's hand before he shakes his opponent's hand at the end of the match, that kind of thing. That was bothersome to me. So, and I noticed that it was interesting. Some people at the Golf Channel also noticed it, and I think they must have gotten some feedback on it, because there is a fine line there between being a coach and being out front and also just letting your players play and play their match.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's you know, eventually I don't know. The way I play a game, I think I just have to go be myself, you know. It like, if I have somebody telling me exactly what to do, I'll probably just screw up.
No, there are a lot of people like that. That's why they're drawn to golf.
So what course would you like to see host major championships, whether it's the PGA or the US Open, that currently isn't hosting major championship golf?
Oh boy, that's an interesting one. I mean, it's tough to say because of the way the ball goes. There are a lot of places that would be great fun to see these guys play, but they just can't. It would just be dumb to watch them try and play it and be tested in a way that was interesting. You just would, you know, a Cypress Point or something like that, or Fisher's Island would be fascinating, but we just won't get that, I don't think, until they do something about the distance. And that, you know, to those places still might not want them. But I guess if I had to vote, the one that would be the most interesting to me to watch the great players play, if they were playing a ball that was suited for the course, would be the National Golf Links of America.
Yeah.
I think that would be the one.
Mm-hmm. It's that's one that I gotta go see here eventually. In terms of, you know, I know you're pretty passionate about the ball and rolling back the ball, and I think I don't know how I hit the ball further every year, you know, if it's not the ball when I'm, you know, in not as good of shape and play less and less, but seemingly I add 5 yards of distance every year, but you know, the ball's not going any further. What would you like to see? You know, like, what do you think is the solution? Is it a pro ball and an amateur ball, or, you know, and how does that work?
I've always loved the idea of a classic course ball and branding it that way and calling it that. And I think it's very similar to what Mike Davis floated, this variable distance ball. What he floated, I think, was a little more intricate in terms of potential ways the ball could go. And it may just be a political reason they put that out there, that you could have a ball that actually goes longer for, say, women to play Erin Hills or whatever it is. It's bring certain courses within reason for lesser talented golfers. But I think that the main focus would be something that allows you to play, that allows an elite golfer to go to Pine Valley and have Pine Valley play like it did 20 years ago. And, you know, that's why I've always kind of liked the classic course concept, because soft spikes really started at Riviera and a few other great old courses and spread because they had that sort of endorsement of the classic course element, and that it was for the good of the maintenance of those courses. And now look where we are, where spikeless is all over the game. And I think that having some of those courses, a Marion, a Cypress Point, a Pine Valley, be able to be played and also turn in a score for handicapping purposes with a ball that
is accounted for would be the way to start it and see where it goes. But I think the architectural element is more interesting. And then, you know, the pros, it has to happen. There's just no way. I don't know how they're going to play some of these venues coming up on the U.S. Open circuit after what we saw at Erin Hills without a ball suited those weeks. And we'll have to listen to all the whining about, oh, it's so hard to adjust and how dare you do that. And it's hogwash, of course, because they just went down to the Mexico City where there's altitude and they all whip out their track man and they make some adjustments. And I mean, you talk about what a non-story that ended up being, because it's just so, it's never been easier to adjust your equipment and your thinking on distance with TrackMan and with the knowledge that, you know, the caddies are so good now and they know so much. And so that element of, say we had a Masters ball at Augusta and every company made it and they made their they made the specs and they tested them, yeah, it's a little bit of a pain. And yeah, there's going to be a situation where somebody's going to wonder if somebody's playing a juiced ball, but I don't think that's going to happen too much. And I think it has to happen. I think it will happen. I really do. I think that the climate has changed and people are kind of realizing that it's not growing the game as we've been told it would.
Yeah. I played Chicago golf last week and something I noticed is just like, you know, like the principal's nose bunker on double plateaus is completely useless now. I mean,
yeah.
where it used to be something that people would have to work, like you hit a bad drive and all of a sudden you have this bunker to contend with. Now it's almost more of a bunker off the tee than it is for a second shot. And you see this and it's like, wow, this is this great golf course where you have this beautiful architecture with like Barrett's holes and Redans, and it's so rare to play a Redan actually the way a Redan should be played because the ball goes so high and you're hitting such short shots into this 200-yard hole, you know. And the same with a Barrett's, it's almost impossible to run the ball up to it.
Well, and that's the biggest change since I've been bitching and moaning about distance. That when I started that, good players would always go, well, just put a tee back, just do this, just grow the rough, narrow it. And you know, I'd get pretty frustrated with that. And then it's just gradually changed where people no longer, and this is the exciting thing to me is that you no longer have to convince somebody that those things are bad ideas. It's people have come to realize, wait a second, we have this architectural treasure. Why would you do these things to it just because the ball and the equipment is so good now? And so I think that the climate is out there that good players now no longer feel like it's the job of the course to really adjust to the equipment. And so that's a huge, huge change. And you hear it in players. I hear it in people who go to Pine Valley, like, oh, well, that wasn't very hard. You know, you want to say, well, one, the sand used to be all footprints and death if you hit it in there. And two, it's short. You don't even hit many drivers there anymore unless you play a few of those silly new back tees, and those are kind of absurd. But so that to me is an exciting change that good players are now kind of on board. Like, oh yeah, I'm not really getting tested the way I want to be tested and it's not as fun.
Mm-hmm. So outside the ball, like what do you think has been kind of like the biggest technological advance that's kind of diminished skill in the game?
Oh, the size of the driver head for sure. And that's one that Adam Scott feels very strongly about just reducing the size of the head a little bit, and you'd see a big change in distance and also a reward for the truly great drivers of the ball. And I would love to see that. I think I would love to see an event that does that. Just limits the size of the head and let's look at the numbers and let's see how it plays and let's see if it remains in line with who the best drivers are driving the best that week. I think it would be fascinating. And, you know, things like that we just don't do. You know, NASCAR has restrictor plates on cars for certain tracks. Why don't we do that in golf, where we have our version of restrictor plates, so that the architecture can shine and the course doesn't have to make silly changes.
Yeah, I love that idea. I think, I mean, you see the change in the way people even swing, and you know, this new era of the young 20 somethings have grown up with these massive driver heads, and their swings reflect it.
Yeah.
I mean, they're swinging up on the ball, and they really swing pretty much as hard as they can, knowing that, hey, my miss
yep.
isn't really that big of a deal. You know, I remember playing like small 190 cc heads. That if you mishit it, I mean, it was going nowhere and really far right or left.
Oh yeah, yeah, it was cruel, and I don't want to go back to those days for all of us. And I don't even think that we're talking about a reduction in the driver head size that would be even close to that. But just even a slight reduction, which is what Adam Scott's mentioned, would make a huge difference, 330 or somewhere in there. And that, but we won't know until we try it. So we need that to happen first.
So curious, you know, say I gave you this like this great piece of land, unlimited budget, and you could resurrect any architect, dead or living, you know, and you wanted to, you know, do a whole, you know, a course. Who would you have design your course?
I'm obviously, I have a strong bias towards George Thomas and Billy Bell. Mm-hmm. So it would be them, or it would be McKenzie with Robert Hunter, probably. I feel like in terms of the whole package of design and artistry and construction function and just beauty and that those were the teams that kind of took it to another level. And I think Thomas was the master more than anybody at creating something that looked great the first time you saw it, but then had enough intricacies within that would make you want to play it over and over again. And his view was that era of golf architecture, what they did was just the beginning, and that we'd have more courses with the intricacies of the old course, the day-to-day variety, and McKenzie wrote that too. And that didn't happen, obviously. We went backwards instead of courses that were actually more complicated in their design in a way that was fascinating and in line with what drew people to the old course to begin with, which I think is fascinating that they viewed it that way.
Mm-hmm. It's yeah.
But it makes sense. You would think because remember, their view was, well, we were just trying to get people away from a certain kind of bad penal design and unattractive looking courses and courses that didn't drain and look good. And so logic would tell you, okay, we've got it back to this point, but now the next generation is going to go this way. Well, it turned out it went the opposite.
It's interesting too, because like the architecture behind really great strategic holes is really kind of simple, and it just seems like what happened was got overdone, and the subtlety is what makes really intricate and great design is subtle little things, not 65 bunkers down the left side of a fairway.
Well, what's funny too is that with better construction machinery and more knowledge and more technology to do things, we actually went backwards in terms of the attention to detail and creating those little intricacies that would make it better and long term. A golf course would have more permanence, and you know, I think their view was that the more you got that kind of technology to build a course, faster, it would allow you to spend more time working out the details and the little stuff that we love. But it's gone the opposite way. It's just people build it faster and crank it out and move on to the next thing, or they did. And obviously we're shifting backwards now, in that, and Corin Crenshaw are really the ones who, I mean, Pete Dye kind of started it with opening our eyes to links golf, but then Corin Crenshaw have kind of taken it to the next level on the construction and subtlety side, and getting that great mix of something that looks visually enticing, but then also has real charm when you play it.
Mm-hmm. It's, you know, so I know you've written a great book on Cyprus, and something I've been curious to ask you is, you know, obviously Rayner did the routing there and, you know, passed away. So, you know, then McKenzie took over. What do you think the course, and how do you think it would be compared to the course that's there now, it had Rayner done that job?
I always struggle with the idea of his aesthetic working on that land. It just really just is hard to picture. As much as I love his golf courses, I just don't know if that's what would have worked there compared to what was built with the sort of fringy bunkers that mimic the shapes of the cypress trees. And, you know, the routing changed quite a bit after he passed away. It changed from McKenzie's first routing. And that's all stuff that they were bickering with Samuel Morse about the 14th hole they wanted along the cliffs, and they had the 17-mile drive that ended up going there, and that was kind of a late in the game change, and there were other changes. So that's kind of my sense. I'm not glad that Seth Rayner died when he died, but for the sake of Cypress Point, I think for that site it was what they ended up with was the right style of architecture for that kind of ground.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of my favorite, you know, pictures in all of golf is like the 14th hole that goes down and to the right, and you see the water, but then the bunkers, how they just kind of creep up into the dunes. I mean, it's a natural look that's almost unparalleled on any other course in America, at least. So, you know, in terms of, you know, so say you can have any course in America to restore, you know, it could be a public, it could be a private, you know, like what course, you know, sticks out in your head as one that you would love to do a restoration or, you know, slash renovation of?
Well, on the public side, obviously I'm hopeful that something happens at Sharp Park. I'm hopeful that, you know, someday that something like Cobbs Creek will happen. That's another amazing site potentially. Mm-hmm. It's just an incredible opportunity. But I think if there was one golf course I would love to see restored and would love to try to figure out how to do it, would be Pebble Beach, and getting it back to the 1929 Chandler Egan, post Chandler Egan redo look. And I that's the one that the more people who see the photos of that and ask questions, the more I think it just gets so intriguing to realize what it became when Egan redid it and how it changed from that. I think it would just blow people away. It would be incredible.
So, you know, I think, you know, obviously one of the issues there is kind of the commercialization of Pebble Beach and, you know, but, you know, I think with what Mike Kaiser and Corin Crenshaw are doing is they're promoting a rougher look is a good look. So, you know, I think, you know, I would say, and personally, I think, you know, 5-10 years, it might not be that crazy to, you know, to foresee that being a viable option. Would you agree?
I agree. Yeah. I think that the trend is such that they will, I think, you know, rankings don't have a lot of positive, uses these days, but one thing that they are useful for is highlighting a course, kind of getting left behind in a way in the restoration world that we're seeing now, that, as you said earlier, that the there aren't, I can't name any of these where people did a pure restoration where people were really unhappy. In fact, I can't name one at all.
Yeah, I can't either.
I'm sure there's something that, you know, I've heard like somebody, some people at Colonial don't like what Keith Foster did, although they liked it initially. So I, you know, I don't know. That one looks like he did a very nice job to me, but maybe more people hearkening back to wanting the Hogan era look to it. And there were some things changing, floods, whatever. But I mean, that's really, I think, getting desperate trying to find an example. So I think that when you look at that and the rankings and panelists rewarding places that do this and rewarding them, not because just because they did it, because they go there and they play and they go, wow, this is so much fun, especially if they played it before. And that's something that, yeah, where Pebble Beach could succumb. It's just, as you know, that it's such a, to close that course down and do that, and the economic impact on the course, the lodge, and the 17-mile drive area would be pretty incredible. I think we were bored one day at the U.S. Open last time it was there and did the math. A few people, we were sitting around and coming up with some possible numbers. I can't remember what they were, but they were hefty on the impact to the region if they were to shut the course down for 9 months.
You know, just get Cypress Point to open up to the public, right? That'll happen.
That's not going to happen. Yeah, not going to happen. Although, you know, it really, Samuel Morse developed it. It was part of the, it's part of the family. You know, yeah. Maybe it could do that for a little while. They could charge $2,000 green fees and they'd probably be booked immediately.
You know, my grandpa used to go out to there, and I guess they used to sell like these week passes to Cypress if you knew a member or something. So he'd get it for like a week, and one time one of his buddies came out, and his buddy hadn't ever seen Pebble, so he insisted that they go play. And like, you know, till his deathbed, it was one of my grandfather's like greatest regrets was having to leave Cypress to go play Pebble for a day.
Yeah, I can understand that. Of course, it's a nice problem to have, because Pebble, even and don't get me wrong, in this state, it's still a great experience. It's still great fun to play. There's still nothing quite like it.
So, you know, one of the courses I'd love to see like a restoration of, and I'm sure you're pretty familiar with it being from L.A., and I'd just love to hear your two cents, is Rancho Park.
Hmm. Yeah, Rancho is more of a needing, just needing some care. Not that the people who work there don't care. It's just that the city of L.A. has kind of neglected its all of its courses and doesn't know really what people want in terms of turf. You know, they think people want green grass, but then we've had our drought, so they've cut the water back. And I mean, I hear. Rancho is so baked out at times that it's just it's not good firm. It's not links firm. It's this baked out rock hard thing that hurts when you hit a ball. And so it's a sensational golf course in terms of being a test of every shot, every stance and lie, and you have to move the ball, and it's really fun that way. And the players who always played there, I caddied in the senior tour event when it was there, and the old guys who would play there are the Trevinos, and they used to get great fields at that event. Jack Nicklaus never played, but of course Arnold Palmer had a great relationship with Rancho Park and always played, and Trevino and Player would play, and it was so much fun watching those guys hit shots around there. Billy Casper slinging these big, that was at the point where he was hitting a huge hook. And watching him play that golf course and shape shots, and then watch somebody like Al Geiberger kind of go around with his smooth tempo, or Dave Stockton grinding it out. And it really is an amazing place that you wish would be just better, just a little better presented. And I think they've taken a hit, interestingly. It's not as crowded as it used to be. Of course, it used to be ridiculous. You couldn't, people would spend the night to get out there. And now you can go out in any afternoon and get out pretty easily. And part of that's the state of golf. Part of it's the state of the way they they run it and present it. They don't have a pro shop. I mean, the vendors of all the pro shops in the city of LA, other than I believe the barbers still at Griffith Park, have walked away from their shops. They just, the city can't even make those work and make it work for them. So
unbelievable.
It's one of the reasons why I think people aren't very excited about the Olympic golf when it comes here. It's like, oh great, we're going to go to Riviera, and meanwhile we have this public course system that's kind of in shambles. And wouldn't it be nice if we could have this be nicer, and or even maybe use something like Griffith Park for the games, but we are not there.
Have they picked Riviera as the site officially?
Yeah, they okay. did. They did. Yeah. They were originally going to consider a public course renovation, and they, when the IOC went in on the whole use existing venues thing, they gravitated towards Riviera, and it's going to be very interesting, because I don't sense a lot of good vibes from people that's going to be something that gets people excited, especially if the format doesn't get more interesting fairly quickly, because it's a course we see every year, and so we're just going to go play another stroke play event at Riviera. That's great. That's not very exciting.
I mean, you think about the money they put into like the Rio course. If you could put that into a course like Rancho Park, I mean, how good would that place be?
And there's just such a different vibe when you play a tournament in the middle of the city at a course that the public can play. Those Champions Tour events, well, it was a senior tour then at Rancho, used to get huge crowds. I mean, amazing for LA, you know, 20,000-25,000 people on the weekend. And granted, you know, you had Trevino and some others not long past their prime playing, and Arnold Palmer, that's going to get people there. But the energy is just so different, and there's just nothing like it in tournament golf. But it's needs work.
Yeah, it's I used to live when I lived in LA for 6 months, and one of my places was like right next to Rancho Park. I could walk there.
Nice.
And you know, yeah. I'd go out there at like 5-6 o'clock. Like, and I mean, it's got the bones of such a good court. I think about it all the time.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, in terms of a city owned course, like bones, and you know, it could be a really great golf course. So something I'll just keep hoping for, but it doesn't sound like it's got much of a chance. So, so I'm kind of, we'll get you out of here. You know, so got the holiday weekend. We do, our tradition is, overrated, underrated. So we're going to fire some topics at you, and you just say overrated, underrated. The short par four.
I actually have come to the conclusion it's underrated, and for a couple reasons. One, we're just starting to see people design more and more of them that are better and doing different things strategically. By the way, am I supposed to give long answers in these, or am I supposed
you can do whatever you want.
Yeah, but I think the other thing that besides the fact that we're just now starting to see all these cool iterations of holes and offshoots is that in the era of technology, the short par five has kind of died as the great risk reward hole. And the short par four has kind of picked up the slack, and it's made, I think, people more than anything that's gone on, the interest in short par fours and tournament golf in the last 15, 20 years has raised awareness of what architecture means to tournament golf, what architecture means to everyday golf, and how fun well-designed holes can be. And I think it's all the short par four, maybe a few great risk reward par fives, but short par fours, everybody can enjoy the dynamics. You know, the average golfer can be playing a match with a better player and beat them on those holes because they play it nice and safe. Mm-hmm. And the good player gets greedy, that kind of thing. And so I can't get enough of them, and I hope it just keeps going and people keep demanding more of them on every course.
Yeah, I really like it. I think part of the issue, and it's obviously like a huge, you know, viewing standpoint. Like there's like a, you know, a viewing appeal to it. Something that drives me nuts though is how people like don't appreciate long par fives. like how it like it has this stigma of like it, when they were out at Baltusrol and everybody was like all over the 17th hole for like, oh, it's so boring. It's like that's like one of the greatest long par fives in golf, you know? And I think the short
I
par
guess,
four has kind
yeah.
of led to that. And it's like, well, like, you know, they're great architecture isn't just, you know, I don't know. I think they're almost overrated because they've become so popular. But that's just me
I
being
think,
a contrarian.
yeah. One of the interesting things that's happened though on the long par five, and I would agree with you in the sense that they have lost their luster because you in the technology era, you felt so much pressure on the tee shot and the second shot to hit two good shots to give yourself that good third. And now you hear this all the time. The guys will, good players will tell you, well, it's just a 100-yard par three. We couldn't go for it, and so they forced us to basically play a 100-yard par three. And I don't disagree with that assessment. But it also, you know, helps when you can hit it 320 yards, and then you can hit a hybrid, you know, 270. Yeah, it took 700 yards. Oh yeah, and by the way, we just had almost 700 yards at Erin Hills with not much roll. And we still had guys get home in two.
Yeah.
So to actually build a long par five that does what you're getting at, which is put that importance on every shot, you really have to, I think, for good players, have about 800 yards,
It
which
is
is
kind of
insanity.
crazy. Yeah. I mean,
Yeah.
well, when you hit 380-yard tee shots, it's or it needs to be like
There
700.
wasn't that much roll. That's what's scary. And there wasn't that much wind. It was just slightly downwind and a little bit of roll, but nothing abnormal.
Maybe they need to go uphill.
That was nuts.
Yeah, it's
And oh yeah, by the way, it basically is flat, or the last part of that 18th hole at Erin. It's just is a little slightly up. I mean, it
the
was
tee shot
insanity
was
what those
down
guys were
though.
doing.
Tee shot was
Yeah,
down.
the tee shot is elevated, correct.
Yeah,
But
most
I
of
mean,
them were out though.
not like you're driving off a cliff. It was incredible what they did there.
When
It's incredible.
are
And
people
by the
going
way,
to get used to it?
I heard nobody in the press tent going, "Wow, that's amazing." It was like, "Okay, this is ridiculous. This is absurd." And that's a big change. A few years ago, if I had said, and I was the one just sitting there going, "Man," just nodding and. I didn't have a strong view either way because I'm used to this, the ridiculousness of this now, but it was fascinating. That was the takeaway. Was not, oh, these guys are amazing athletes. That is so awesome. They did that on a 687-yard hole. It was consistently, okay, enough, enough's enough. We have to
Yeah.
do something.
Yeah, it's out of control. I played golf last year with a 14-year-old who hit it like 15 yards past me. I hit it like 300 yards. And I was like, when I was 14, literally when I was 14, I hit it 200 yards.
Yeah, I know, it's insane. And they have no, the only thing I don't, you know, and I hate to sound like a old fuddy-duddy, but where it does bother me is the game is no longer humbling these kids. And I think there is some positive element in the game. I don't want to go back to hickories and being humbled by hitting a snap hook 180 or in the persimmon and steel. That's we don't need to do that, but it would be nice if they had to swing just slightly more cautiously at the ball. But with TrackMan and the equipment, the combination, you're just going to keep seeing more guys like Champ from Texas A&M, and who just are freakishly long.
And I think it diminishes like the impact of like, you know, great long iron players, you know, because
Oh, absolutely.
there aren't any long irons anymore. You know, long irons
No.
are, you know, an occasional par three and pretty much, you know, par fives.
Yeah, no, it's definitely a lost part of the game.
So
And
next.
then, by the way, at a lot of venues, it's all the driver also gets taken out of their hands because of this. So, and to me, that's a shame too. I want to see the driver used.
What do you think about hosting a tournament at like a 6,800 yard classic course that's like obviously if it rained at all. You know, we'd have to put a dome over it. But that's like, you know, nice and crispy, you know, firm and fast, where, you know, guys could go for the green, but all of a sudden, you know, if you hit into the wrong spot, you've got, you know, impossible angles and so on and so forth. What do you think about a golf tournament being played at something like that?
It would be nice, but, you know, if you're okay with them hitting iron off most of the tees, which is where we're headed, I'm not okay with that. I like to see the driver used to gain a reward, and that's the problem. That's where you need the ball that is better suited for those courses.
Yeah, it's true. Next topic, we'll do modern green design, overrated, underrated.
Well, they're overrated in that most of them aren't very good, so they're underrated in how bad they are. So, I, and it's not all the architect's fault, but it's two things. It's the one that the USGA green or the modified USGA green is just very hard to construct and very hard to tie into the surrounds and to kind of have the fairway just meld into the green. I mean, the best courses, you feel like the green is almost just an extension of the contours of the ground and the fairway, and I think that's why people respond to links golf so much, because that's exactly what they are. So when you're playing this kind of nice gentle ground and then you come upon this thing that's sort of propped up artificially and over contoured, it's offensive to me and to most people's senses, and a lot of it's the construction of USGA green is just very hard to do that. That's why Coren Crenshaw don't build USGA greens. They dump a big area of sand where the green complex is and then meld it into the fairway and the surrounding landscape.
Yeah, I think one of the things that's happened with like the modern era of architecture, where, you know, we've got this playability and we get all this width, is that architects focus like, oh, I'm going to make this tough for the good player by making this green crazy undulated, you know? And then it's like, but like, to me, I think, you know, when you have that big undulation, it's almost easier because you can see the break, you know, like it's very clear which way this putt breaks. And, you know, you see these classic courses, a lot of them, you get on the green and there'll be these small little subtleties with the flatter greens where you can't even see the break, and it and you're like, oh, this is right edge, and then you miss it a ball right because it moves a little, and that's what drives, you know, players nuts. Versus, you know, that average player is just going to try and ram it in the back of the hole and probably makes it.
No, subtlety in green design is definitely something that I think that's why people love what Ben and Bill do. They have kind of that character that you just described.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting. It'll be interesting to see how it continues to progress. But I think that less is almost more in greens. So, Jordan Spieth, overrated, underrated?
Well, I don't think he's overrated as a talent. I think he gets a lot out of his ability. I think he's a complicated individual, I think, more so than people realize. And I don't know if he should be trying to be calmer and quieter on the course, or if it'd be like Lee Trevino trying to shut him up and make him less funny and more serious if it would backfire in that sense as it would with Jordan. I think that he's I think he's an incredible talent, and it's amazing what he's doing right now with his putting really not being even close to what it was, and looking so bad sometimes over the ball. I mean, I don't think people are giving him enough credit how good his ball striking has gotten. And, you know how the game is. Of course, as soon as you work on that, you know, another part gets neglected, and I think that's what's happened with him a little bit. So if the putting just comes back to being solid, doesn't even have to be what it was in 2015, I think he's really, really going to win a lot. So I don't know. Maybe I'd say underrated in the sense that I think he's underrated in how many things he's doing well. But I do wonder about the attitude. If all that, I mean, this Fox picked up so much dialogue at Aaron Hills. My gosh, he talks a lot on the course. he puts so much energy into all this immediate reactions to the shots and then the play by play. And I part of me thinks that's great. That's his nervous energy. That's how he functions. But part of me wonders, geez, over 5.5 hours.
Yeah.
That's got to get exhausting.
It's interesting. I think it was either, was it Phil that said you either have to be like incredibly intelligent or like extremely dumb to be really great at golf?
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think he's on the spectrum of incredibly intelligent and has, you know, is thinking about so many different levels of things that me and you would never even, you know, come across our mind. Versus, you know, a Boo Weekly. I mean, talk about all-time
right
contrasts and final pairings. Like, you
yeah.
know, I think he's underrated. You know, you hear people say like, oh, he got lucky to win that tournament. Like, well, like, you know, to a certain degree, like, you can't get lucky and win. Like, what has he won 10 times now?
Yeah, that's not luck.
Yeah,
that's skill.
So
I think the thing that's fascinating about him that fascinates us with a lot of these players like a Nicklaus or Bobby Jones is that you're right. They are very thoughtful, introspective. They're noticing every little detail. And when you see somebody like that and you know golf, and Ben Crenshaw is the same way. He notices every little thing about a golf course, but they are able to set aside whatever feelings they have about a course or the setup or the weather or this or that, and ultimately just try to get the job done. And yeah, he's had times where he's, I think, lost a little of that just because he's pressing. But I think ultimately we're fascinated by those players way more than the one who's, and nothing against Dustin Johnson, but who just kind of quietly just goes and doesn't really think too much. I mean, we admire the way he handled Oakmont. But in terms of watching the sport, it's always been more interesting to study somebody who is thinking so much in a sport where you have so much time to think, but then is able to set things aside most of the time and play the shots no matter how they feel about them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think.
Or the circumstances.
He's I think if you were going to say one player to move the needle in this post-Tiger generation, he's the only one that really could, you know?
Yeah, right now he's the one that has a certain it factor that would be – obviously no one's going to, I don't think, ever reach the level of Tiger in terms of being intriguing to general sports fans. He's just one of a kind. Somebody might come along, but I do sense that Spieth has – something that makes people, well, the numbers show it, that makes people want to tune in and watch him down the stretch. That's different than take your pick, any of the other top players.
Yeah. So we'll do one more here. Omar, you're rusty as a PGA pro.
I don't know if he's underrated or overrated. You probably have noticed I did not take on this vital topic. This is to me, a first world issue. I'm far more offended by people who played the tour for several years regaining their amateur status than a guy who played the tour who has become a sweater folder and made his way into the PGA Championship, where they give 20 spots. 20, okay? It wasn't like he took the lone spot. So this controversy to me spoke to a certain kind of really delusional almost sense of what the Club Pro Championship means to the PGA. Look, 19 other guys got in, calm down, and that was kind of it for me. I'm much more bothered by somebody who made a lot of money on the tour and then is going and competing as an amateur again. That doesn't sit as well.
Yeah, you know,
I don't know if it sits well with anybody, does it?
Well, I was in the mid-am last year, and I'm looking down the field, and I'm like, Mike Muir, didn't he play on? I look it up. He made like almost made $1 million playing on tour, and he's now mid-am. I'm like, how am I and him at all in the same, you know, field here, and you got guys like Jess Daly who played for 15, 20 years on many tours. I mean, it to me, and he got his tour card for a year or two. It to me, that is like the biggest. I don't understand how the USGA deems them an amateur because they haven't played for professionally for 2 years.
Yeah, there are a lot of issues with amateur status right now, not to go down a rat hole, but I really think we're at a point that's very dangerous for amateur golf. The combination of the gobs of free equipment, when I play, I had to actually cover my Pepperdine logo in a USGA qualifier a couple times, and that was going too far, obviously. But this idea now, you have kids growing up with wearing all the corporate stuff and getting free equipment. I don't, the concept of the amateur, and I got why it was done. It was to help people who didn't have access versus those who did to great stuff and great equipment. And it is vital in the way the equipment impacts the game now. But I feel like it's undermining amateur golf in a way that's really, really dangerous. We have this Walker Cup in the U.S. Amateur coming up here in Southern California. I don't sense any enthusiasm for either one. I don't think people even know what amateur golf means anymore. So it's like, oh, okay, it's like some, college kids, or what is it? You try to explain it to people. This is a U.S. freaking amateur here. Come on, this used to be a big, big deal. And I just don't know. I think they went a little too far in allowing the rules to bend, and then you throw in things like that, reinstated amateurs, which they're not having the impact that they did early on, but it doesn't make you feel like the amateur game is as pure as it once was or should be.
Something that's really interesting is like how the USGA over the last year has it to me, it looks like they've prioritized, hey, we're kind of more backing professional golf than amateur golf. They eliminated the state team, which was a big mid-am event. Then they cut one of the mid-am spots, and from what I've heard, they're going to cut the second mid-am spot, and then they added another professional tournament.
I'm sorry, on the Walker Cup, you mean?
Yeah.
No, that, and I think that was a mistake, though, too. And that all David Fay said it best when it happened. He said it should have just been an unwritten rule. You're going to take two mid amateurs because there's going to be a year, and this year could even be the year where you actually want to take three. You don't know the way college golfers are turning pro. There are going to be years where you don't want to take any, or you only take one. And to have made it this set number was almost demeaning to the mid amateur game to me. That like they needed this charitable assistance. Mm-hmm. But anyway, go on.
but then so they eliminate the state team, and then they're eliminating these spots, so it's like you're killing the amateur, because you're saying, hey, we're going to field a team of all future pros, and then they add, they eliminate state team and add the U.S. Women's Senior Open, another professional tournament. And to me, it's just like, it leaves me scratching my head. It's like, what's the difference between the state team and which one actually moves the needle more, the Senior Women's Open? Is there an audience for that?
I don't think so, and especially with the age limit being 50, I think that's too old. I think that really women mature faster, and their careers peak accordingly, and that it should have been 45 years old, but that's another story. It'll be at a great golf course, so there's that. But yeah, I think that the USGA in general look, they made their first tee starter at the US Open as a longtime golf pro, and not to pick on him, but if you told Frank Hannigan or some of PGA Boatwright that they'd made the first tee announcer's job a lifetime appointment to a longtime PGA pro and not a somebody who serves the game in the amateur game or has served the USGA, they would just lose their minds. Like, what are you trying to do here? Are you trying to be, and Frank always warned against this, trying to be loved. And that's kind of what's happened. I'd also throw in, I'm not sure how the four balls have really gone over very well yet so far. I'm not sensing the time of year is working. And for the people that they wanted to be playing in those events, does that seem like a fair observation?
It is a bad time of the year. Like, you know, like for example, like I play my qualifier in like October, you know, and then the event is in end of May. You know, it's like, you know, I don't know. The date
seems to have been chosen to try to prevent college players from being able to play in it. What's the best date for the majority? And I don't see how, as somebody who, you know, that they were hoping to get, the person who's plays club invitationals with a partner, that date works for them. I don't see it.
Well, the other issue is that you just have these kids that'll go qualify. They're college players. If their team doesn't make it to the nationals, then they play the four ball, you know?
Right. Right.
So you haven't even protected that aspect of it, but you know, that's a whole bag of worms that about 2,000 people in the world care about. So
yeah, we don't need to go down that rabbit hole. But I think it is worth exploring, because it overall what it speaks to is, you know, the USGA is I'm not going to say they're in crisis, but they definitely have an identity issue that they're obsessed with their brand and branding them, and that's why you see their logo everywhere. And this is the problem. They want to be loved, and so if we get back to the ball issue, they know that won't go over well, as does the RNA, if they do try and introduce something. So that is a big issue going forward on whether we ever get something done, because they will they act or not act out of fear of being vilified and hated for doing something. And that's why I I'm encouraged by the variable distance ball concept that they floated, because I think they found something which was kind of the argument a lot of us made all along, was if you tailor balls to certain architecture and courses, nobody can argue with that. You know, go play your current ball at Erin Hills, but if you want to play Pine Valley the way it was supposed to be designed, or you want to play Rancho Park at 6,500 yards the way Lee Trevino played it in the 70s in the LA Open, and really, really get to have a great, great fun test of golf and hit some long irons and shape some shots, play the variable, the 20% or the 10% reduced ball here. And you'll get your money's worth, kind of thing. So it'll be very interesting to see if they're able to sell it. That's going to be the key.
Why doesn't a company just start making them? Like, I don't know how big the market would be, but like, I would for sure play this.
I'm with you. And back to soft spikes. I've never understood why somebody doesn't want to be the first to do, and again, it's all in the packaging. You know, it's not gonna taint. I get, you know, maybe they look at things like Coke and Classic Coke, and think, you know, there must be corporate business school stuff that's taught that they've picked up, because I just can't grasp why you wouldn't want to be the ball that caters to somebody like you or to Buddy Marucci's of the world, or other people who play great golf courses and who are good players. Why you wouldn't? It just seems like a not a complicated thing to do to appeal to that group, because they're tastemakers. Let's face it, mm-hmm. these old classic golf clubs can change things, and the soft spikes example is the perfect example of that. That people are like, what are these stupid things? Like, nobody's ever going to go away from spikes. And these places mandated it. They changed them out. Soft spikes became a verb or a noun. I'm not sure what would that be? It would be a, well, anyway, it's like Xerox, you know, instead of making photocopies, you make a Xerox. So I'm not sure why a company doesn't want to be that one. I mean, Bridgestone, I believe, is the one that's made balls for the USGA that they've tested, but they've yet to come to market with this ball. and I think it's and it's hard to get a hold of them even.
I'm
like they're asteroids, you know. And if you look at them too long, you'll lose your eyesight or something. Give me a break.
I'm looking at eBay right now. You know, I'm thinking about buying some Tour Bolatas and taking them out for a spin next time I play somewhere.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, yeah. I've got some. I was cleaning a closet here, and I got some professionals that I kept. You know, now that was the ball where it kind of made the first big leap. So. Yeah. The Tour Bolata would be the one, but I don't miss the days of those where you just breathe on them and you could you know cut them. But
blade a wedge and they're done. But
oh,
the market,
was, yeah, sayonara.
The market for them's rough. It's like $55 for a dozen. Unbelievable.
Ooh.
You know, would actually wow. You know, so might have to go to some garage sales. So
yeah, but, that's you may have to stumble on them.
Now that we're talking about going to garage sales, I think we've hit our time here. So,
yep.
Hey,
yep.
I appreciate the time. And you got anything exciting coming up?
I'm heading to the UK for a few days at the Scottish Open and then the Open Championship. And I'm going to go see the new golf course at Turnberry. And I'll probably play a late evening 9 or 18 at Prestwick. So things are good here. I'm looking forward. I've never been to Birkdale. I just started reading about it. I know very little. All I know is people love it. They don't really know why, but people just really respond to that course. So I'm very excited to see that as a venue. I think it should be a lot of fun, and it's a wide open championship. So
yeah,
if you have any suggestions on other courses around that area, I'm all ears.
I've never been, but you know, I read a lot.
Yeah.
I mean, it's, it seems like there's, it's like the best area in England for golf, you know, is that Birkdale
yeah.
area.
That's the view, but so far from what I've seen, that area is great, but it's still really hard to beat Scotland.
You should try and get out to Swinley Forest and Elwoodley.
Swinley. Don't call it Swinley. That you'll upset the members there. You won't get invited out.
I know. Just walking.
Swine.
Pig.
Yeah. It's one area that I have not been able to do in depth, the Heathlands area. So it's definitely a priority. It's just that London this year is just not a city that I want to get too close to.
Yeah.
So
stay on the outskirts.
Anyway, but
you know,
I'm looking forward to the Scottish.
Find a farmhouse or something. Get out there and get out of the hustle and bustle, you know?
Absolutely.
All right. Well, Jeff, thanks so much, and we'll talk soon.
All right, thanks, Andy.